I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The inauguration of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris will begin later this morning, but it will not be like past ceremonies. Washington, D.C. is under lockdown after the assault on the U.S. Capitol 2 weeks ago, and the pandemic has limited the crowd so it won't be a super spreader event. While Presidents Obama, Bush, and Clinton and their spouses will be on the dais, President Trump and Melania Trump refused to attend and to acknowledge Trump lost the election. WHYY's Mark Eichmann is there in D.C. and joins us on Radio Times. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Marty. Good morning.
Good morning. What does the Capitol look like?
Well, it's kind of like a ghost town. You said there's a lockdown here in D.C., and I think that phrase has been overused over the past year. This is a legitimate lockdown compared to maybe what we've seen other places. Folks will remember what the sports complex in Philadelphia looked like during the 2016 Democratic National Convention, with it, everything kind of cordoned off and sealed off. And just imagine that put into Center City for blocks and blocks and blocks. There's like nothing moving. Nobody can get in or out vehicle-wise. It's very quiet for Inauguration Day here. It's a bit weird.
So just what? Reporters, National Guard, police, Secret Service? Is that basically who's going to be attending this inauguration?
Yeah, and that too. And so I'm just outside the perimeter gates. So that's who will be inside. You know, it'll be like almost like a session of Congress is what Delaware State University President Tony Allen described it at. He's in charge of the inauguration committee. But then outside of that, it's reporters like me who don't have credentials to get inside. Police and National Guard members, just a couple, you know, maybe five or six, ten sprinkled out through different intersections around the perimeter of folks showing up. There was a street preacher who showed up with a mega horn to spread the word to the National Guard. But that's pretty much it. A very, very, very sparse gathering of people here outside the perimeter gates.
Is Delaware, Pennsylvania, are they going to play a prominent role today? Obviously where Biden grew up and where he lives today, of course.
Yeah, a Delaware pastor, Reverend Sylvester Beeman, is playing a very prominent role in the actual ceremony. He'll deliver the benediction to end the ceremony. It's a pastor Biden has known for years and years and years. And it's actually Beeman's church where Biden restarted his campaign after putting it on hold following protests over the murder of George Floyd and others this past summer. It was at Beeman's church where he relaunched his campaign, there's big pictures of him kneeling down inside Beeman's church. So he'll deliver the benediction, and then later on, as Harris and Biden are paraded by a military escort to the White House, they will be accompanied by the University of Delaware drumline, one of just two civilian groups that will participate in that parade.
Well, Mark, it sounds very windy down there, and I thank you for joining us. And, of course, WHYY will be checking in with you throughout the day. Mark Eichmann, reporter for WHYY, joining us from Washington, D.C. Well, on November 7th, when Pennsylvania's Electoral College votes gave Joe Biden and Kamala Harris enough to win the White House, they spoke at an outdoor rally in Delaware. Harris, the first woman of color to be elected vice president, acknowledged the generations of black women, Asian, white, Latina, Native American women who opened doors to enable her victory.
Women who fought and sacrificed so much for equality and liberty and justice for all, including the black women who are often too often overlooked, but so often prove they are the backbone of our democracy. Tonight I reflect on their struggle, their determination, and the strength of their vision to see what can be unburdened by what has been. And I stand on their shoulders. But while I may be the first woman in this office, I will not be the last. because every little girl watching tonight sees that this is a country of possibilities.
We asked Martha Jones to talk about these women, this moment as Harris prepares to be sworn in, and she joined us by Skype. She's a professor of history at Johns Hopkins University, author of a new book called Vanguard, How Black Women Broke Barriers, Won the Vote, and Insisted on Equality for All. Martha Jones, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, to join our conversation, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Now, Kamala Harris is not the first woman of color to run for president or to run for vice president, but she is the first to get the job. And I wanted to give you a chance, Martha Jones, just to mark this historic day for us.
Sure. Here we are. Just one century from 1920, that year when the Constitution is amended to begin to bring American women to the polls, Senator Harris, now Vice President-elect and soon Vice President Harris, is someone who comes to us out of the tradition of struggle that, yes, gave us the 19th Amendment, but then led African-American women forward into another 45 years of struggle until 1965 and the passage of the Voting Rights Act. So when we hear her invoke the women on whose shoulders she stands, she's giving us a lesson in American political history, not one of the often invoked founding fathers, but of founding mothers. Who also have been a part of shaping American democracy.
And I want to get to some of the women that we should know about, but I also want to just acknowledge that she is, I mean, it's many firsts. She's African-American, she's Asian-American, she's a child of immigrants, and of course, the first woman to have a job in the White House, to have such an important job in the White House.
That's right. And at the same time, to me, the distinction of firsts is, in some sense, too modest a claim. What Senator Harris, now Vice President Harris, represents to us is the force of American women in politics. She is not alone among women of color in Washington. She is not alone among women lawmakers, power brokers, and more in Washington. And I think where we are is at the beginning of an appreciation of now the force that women can be in shaping American politics, getting beyond the shattering of ceilings and to the real business of American politics.
She talked about black women being the backbone of our democracy. This is kind of a broad question, but why have black women believed in democracy when democracy has been so unwelcoming to black women?
Well, it's a long story, as you know, and it goes back to early America when black women, as they contemplate American politics, have to develop a distinct, a unique political philosophy. Because there are so many who doubt women, doubt black Americans, and certainly doubt that black women have any place in the body politic. So I think one of the reasons that black women persist is that they actually believe in democracy, but a sort of democracy that is devoid of racism, that is devoid of sexism, and they believe in that enough that they not only fight for that for themselves, but in fact they lift up the entire nation to a set of aspirations that we might say we're still working to live up to.
Indeed. How important is the role of the church when it comes to empowering black women and giving them voice?
Students of the modern civil rights movement won't doubt me when I say that church is an essential component in the story of African-American politics. Yes, as a place of spiritual sustenance, but as a place for organizing, and for giving political voice to Black Americans. But that story, again, goes all the way back to the beginning of the 19th century with, for example, Black women preachers who are among the first American women to step to podiums, to speak to mixed audiences, to throw off, if you will, the conventions of a more retiring style of womanhood. And it is there that Black women begin to organize with one another, to confer with one another, to debate who they are in society. And so today, when we see Kamala Harris sworn in as Vice President of the United States, among the women upon whose shoulders she stands are those early Black preaching women who broke barriers.
You profiled a woman named, I'm hoping I'm pronouncing her name correctly, Jerina Lee, who was a preacher.
Jerina Lee.
Tell us about
her. So Jerina Lee is living in Philadelphia in the earliest decades of the 19th century. She feels herself called by God to preach, and yet within her church community, the African Methodist Episcopal Church, there are many, if not most, who doubt that women are indeed genuinely called to interpret the word of God and to lead religious communities. Lee persists. She is not only genuine in her calling, she is in her own way an astute politician and manages to persuade her church community that her work, her contributions are essential in the end, to the success, to the growth, to the health of a community like the AME Church. We're so fortunate because Jerina Lee in the 1830s takes a break from her exhausting itinerary and actually pens a memoir. And we can appreciate through those words the ways in which she is already at work on a philosophy that today we often call intersectionality. But she understands, even in the 1830s, the ways in which racism and sexism both are pressing upon her and keeping her from fulfilling her full capacities. Hers is a story of a kind of victory over opponents, and it is one that inspires generations of Black religious women into the future.
And we do have to take a very short break. She's quoted as saying, "Why should it be thought impossible, heterodox, or improper for a woman to preach?" Just to underscore what you just said there. Let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Martha Jones. She's a professor of history at Johns Hopkins University, author of a book came out just a month or so ago called Vanguard, How Black Women Broke Barriers, Won the Vote, and Insisted on Equality for All. We asked her to join us on Radio Times as we mark the historic victory of Kamala Harris to be the first woman of color, the first woman, frankly, to be Vice President of the United States. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can always tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with historian Martha Jones about the historic vice presidency of Kamala Harris and the long line of Black women who have fought for democracy and the critical role they played in 2020. Let me talk to you. You had mentioned the role of Black women in the church, but I'm also thinking the role that Black women played as journalists. In fact, Charlotta Bass was the first Black woman to run for the vice presidency. And see, this was part of the Progressive Party, but she was a journalist, as have other Black women who've played such an important role in our country.
Yeah, journalism, like the church, is one of those well-trod routes that Black women have taken as they emerge into American politics. Charlotta Bass runs for the vice presidency presidency in 1952. She is the editor and owner of the California Eagle in Los Angeles. And for many years before she runs for public office, Bass had been a suffragist advocating for women's votes in California, and then a really important player in politics in Los Angeles, precisely because she exercised the power of the pen. That story can take us all the way back to someone like Marianne Shad Carey, who in the 1850s establishes her newspaper, the Provincial Freeman, here as an exile from the United States in Canada during the years of slavery. And again, someone who is lifting up Black American women, their activism, their ideas, their critiques, and making a place for herself and many others in the roiling politics of the years before the Civil War.
I want to pick up on something you said earlier. Obviously, we just marked the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, giving women the right to vote. But you said it was really the Voting Rights Act that empowered Black women in a way that the 19th Amendment did not. Help us understand that.
Sure. One of the myths about the 19th Amendment is that it guaranteed to American women the right to vote. Not so for African American women who, despite the federal amendment, remain disenfranchised by state laws, poll taxes, grandfather clauses, literacy tests, that, as they had kept Black men from the polls by 1920, will also now be a barrier to Black women's votes, particularly in the American South. This requires the building of a new movement for voting rights, now Black men and women together looking to overcome Jim Crow. And that is a story that takes us indeed all the way to 1965 and passage in that year of the Voting Rights Act.
Well, it also takes us up to present day. And I'm thinking of Stacey Abrams, you know, laying the groundwork for the enfranchisement of voters in Georgia, Latosha Brown, Black Voters Matter, and the fact that it was a squeaker. But Georgia not only gave Biden its Electoral College votes, it also is sending Reverend Warnock and Ossoff to the U.S. Senate.
It's important to underscore that story unfolds after the year 2013, after the U.S. Supreme Court has gutted the most important provisions of the Voting Rights Act. Now, Leader Abrams, Latosha Brown, and others are organizing in the face of a renewed wave of voter suppression efforts that very much parallel what Black women confronted in 1920, 100 years ago. And so the obstacles are formidable in 2020 because we no longer have the protection of the Voting Rights Act. When we appreciate the victories in Georgia, both in the national contest for the presidency, but also in the special Senate election, we have to appreciate how formidable those hurdles were.
This is sort of a weird question, but, you know, looking at what Black women have done for democracy, can Black women steer us through today's turbulent times, the insurrection led by largely white men on the U.S. Capitol, the resurgence of white supremacists? They've been with us all along, but certainly feeling very empowered in the last, years and months of the Trump administration. What can Black women do to help us now?
Well, we will see, won't we?
We will see.
And it's important in part to shift the metaphor, right, from Black women as the backbone, right, to Black women as the head. And here, Vice President Harris, but the many Black women in the U.S. Congress are going to be those who not only do the important, close to the ground, grassroots work of American politics, but are now in a position in a majority party that will permit them to be true leaders, right, to bring the kind of vision that had motivated them from the beginning, right, at the grassroots. Now the question for us is, how does that sort of vision, that sort of commitment, that sort of talent lead us out of what is, I think, by everyone's estimation, an extremely challenging moment in American history.
Mm. I mean, as a historian, can I have you looking into, at least into the near future? Do you feel some degree of optimism that we can meet this moment as a nation?
I absolutely do. And I think it's in part because I am a student of African-American women's vision, of their talent, of their persistence, and of their deep commitment to not only American democracy in a generic or hackneyed sense, right, but into a to a visionary democracy that will look plainly at the challenges that are in front of us and insist that we do our best for Black Americans, yes, but for all of humanity. And that's one of the lessons out of my work, is that Black women have always worked with the best interests of all of us in front of their minds. And I think we can expect that as we go forward.
Well, I really appreciate, frankly, what you just said, and also the fact that you made room in your busy schedule today to join us on Radio Times. Martha Jones, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And she's a professor of history at Johns Hopkins University, author of Vanguard, How Black Women Broke Barriers, Won the Vote, and Insisted on Equality for All. Well, Joe Biden will become the 46th president of the United States at noon today, a job he has wanted for most of his life. He ran multiple times but never got much traction until 2020. He will be the oldest president ever at 78 and began his career at age 29 when he was elected U.S. Senator representing the state of Delaware for 36 years. He was President Obama's vice president, as we all know, and considered a run in 2016, but decided against it after the death of his son, Beau. Our guest Mark Fisher profiled Biden in the Washington Post and wrote about two distinct parts of his personality, his driving ambition, typical of most politicians, and his deeply felt empathy. Fisher is senior editor at the Washington Post, author of Trump Revealed, and joins us on Radio Times. Mark Fisher, nice to have you with us on the show.
It's great to be with you.
And to our listeners, we want to hear from you. This is a historic day. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Biden has run for office untold numbers of times. He is obviously being sworn in today. What has been his driving ambition for this particular office, the President of the United States, Mark?
Well, you know, it's kind of funny. It goes all the way back to childhood. In fact, in college, he drew up a detailed plan for how he would get to the White House. He was once telling that story on a visit to his old Catholic grade school in Delaware, and he was telling the students about his time at the school, and one of the nuns, one of the kids asked, did you always want to be president? And Biden said, oh, no, not always. And one of the nuns in the back of the room piped up and said, I have here in my sleeve, and she pulled out a paper, and it was an eighth grade paper that but Joey Biden had written about wanting to become president of the United States. So this goes way back.
Well, I mean, a lot of little boys and frankly now a lot of little girls say they want to be president of the United States. He really meant it. I mean, why? What did that mean to him, especially even as a young boy?
He always had this sense of needing to achieve, a sort of striving. Came from a father who had bounced from job to job and who always had a kind of a keen interest in status and stature and imbued his son with that. At the same time, his mother imbued him with an enormous sense of humility. Nobody is better than you. You're no better than anyone else. That kind of attitude. And I think for Biden, his stutter played an enormous role in the molding of his character. He was teased as a child. He was he had a very pronounced stutter, and he went through enormous efforts to overcome it, including a period of putting rocks in his mouth and trying to speak that way, which was a trick he picked up from Demosthenes, the ancient Greek orator. And so in overcoming the stutter, I think he really saw that there are people like himself who had some thing that was holding them back, some obstacle, and that through sheer will they could get to extraordinary places. And he became a very charismatic guy who collected a lot of friends. People were drawn to him. And I think he realized that about himself. And that combined with that sense of duty and service to create this ambition.
I mean, that's the empathy part that you write about, that coming from perhaps a stutter, but also, of course, the enormous tragedies, the, you know, the great suffering he's had, losing his wife and young daughter as a young man, that all these difficulties, these tragedies, this suffering has made him an empathetic person.
Yeah, and the Joe Biden that we've seen, that we saw as vice president, who was kind of the empath in chief, who would be sent, as all vice presidents are, to funerals, but far beyond that, would approach ordinary people at rope lines, at events, at rallies, and kind of commune with them in this very intimate kind of way, unusual for even for politicians. And that was not always there. In fact, for the first couple of decades after his first wife, Nelia, and his baby daughter, Naomi, died in this horrific truck crash in 1972. For many years after that, Biden was very reticent in public about talking about tragedy, about loss, about grief. And it's only over time that he came to see that this was something that it would do him good to share with people. And of course, it would do them good as well. And there are some people who've been friends with him for decades who say it didn't really come all to fruition until he lost his son, Bo, to brain cancer just 5 years ago. And he, at that point, he kind of saw that he had the confidence and the stature to really be kind of an ambassador to hurting people of all kinds. And people saw a real change in Biden through the years. He'd always had that empathetic streak, but he wasn't comfortable with making it public until much more recently.
Yeah, and he spoke about Bo yesterday, got rather tearful. In fact, saying, you know, he always thought, or perhaps he believed that Bo should be the president of the United States. That's quite something to say about a child.
There is about Joe Biden a kind of vulnerability that he's willing to show now that very few politicians are willing to show. Certainly, it creates an incredibly stark contrast with President Trump, who believes that showing a vulnerability is being a loser. And so the contrast is enormous, but also for Biden, it's how he learns about what people want and what people what people's hopes are and what's what their obstacles are. And so he it's not that he uses it in a crass way, but he does use it to kind of inform himself about what his priorities should be in political office.
Well, I do want to play a clip. This goes back to actually last February. This is President-elect Joe Biden. He's talking with a 13-year-old. His name is Braden Harrington. This is at a campaign event in New Hampshire. And it's about how he worked through his stutter as a child. As it turns out, Harrington went on to speak at the Democratic National Convention in a video that went viral about his bond with Biden and also how Biden inspired him. I hope I can get through this without crying, but I certainly do. But let's give it a listen.
Hey, what's your name?
Owen. This is my son, Braden.
Hey, Braden, how are you, man?
We're here because he stutters and we wanted to hear you speak.
Oh, man, come on. Hey, I tell you what. Don't let it define you. You are smart as hell. Now, you really are. You can do that. Can I get a phone number for you and I can tell you how what I used to do and how I would do it? Can you take his phone? Because there's about 25 stutterers I continue to work with. And I can tell you the things that help me.
And again, that's Joe Biden. I am wiping away the tears, Mark Fisher, as I listen to that. And it's interesting because when you hear him speaking, maybe it was more at the debates than in other settings, but you can hear the sort of echoes of a stutter or what he had to do to try to contain it, overcome it.
Yeah, there are hesitations, pauses that are quite common in Biden's speech pattern. And some people take that as evidence that he's lost a step, that he's not as cognitively there as he once was. But if you look back through tapes all the way back through his career, those hesitations have always been there. And that's sort of the physical remains of his stutter. And so it's something that he has struggled with throughout his life. And as you heard in that recording, this is something that he can and he wants to connect with people about this, especially about stutters, but about other things as well. It would drive his staff crazy that he would sit, interrupt whatever he was doing to connect with someone like that, and then spend often 10, 15 minutes when he was supposed to be briskly moving through the line.
You say an interesting thing about his stutter, and we know Joe Biden kind of leans into people, crosses that invisible, sometimes physical barrier that people have. He puts his hands on people's shoulders. That is a kind of physical vocabulary he has as a way to perhaps even compensate for some of the linguistic problems he's had.
Yeah, the sort of cliched thing is he talks with his hands and in a New York sort of way, but it goes far beyond that, and he does have a very physical vocabulary. He got him in some trouble early in this election cycle when some people came forward and said he'd been too close. You know, he putting his hands on their hair or that sort of thing, and he seemed genuinely taken aback, very apologetic. It's the way he's always operated. Some people find it immensely affecting and powerful, and some people find it offensive and difficult. So, he's sort of backed away from that as a result of this sensitivity that has emerged. But it's who he is, and it created this sort of politics of intimacy that has been kind of his trademark through the years.
We'll just take a short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Mark Fisher. He's senior editor at The Washington Post, wrote a book, a year or so ago called Trump Revealed. We're actually talking about a profile he did of Joe Biden, President-elect Joe Biden, in The Washington Post, talking about both his driving ambition and his deeply felt empathy, making him a rather unusual politician. We want to hear from you. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can pick up the phone and make a call at 1-888-477-9499. What do you think of President-elect Joe Biden? Give us a call. We'll be right back. This is Radio
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Mark Fisher, senior editor of The Washington Post, about Joe Biden. We'll also spend a little time talking about President Trump. And we want to hear from you. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Mark, you say that Joe Biden either ran or thought about running, I think, something like 7 times. So clearly it's a job he has wanted to have. But he ran into trouble. He was not a particularly good candidate. He got caught up in a plagiarism scandal. His gaffes got him into trouble. What did he need to learn in those early runs for the White House?
You know, in a strange way, he seemed to need to learn to have confidence in his own intellectual capacity. A lot of his early aides talk about how back in the 80s, he wasn't so sure that he had the ability to understand and work through policy and what the job that he was doing as a young senator. And it wasn't until 1987, he was running for president in the 88 cycle and not doing well at all. And as you mentioned, he got caught up in this plagiarism scandal where he was going around making speeches about his own past and kind of his rise up through education and from kind of a lower status. And he picked up the language of the British politician Neil Kinnock and talked about how his ancestors had worked in the Pennsylvania coal mines. Well, they never did. And that was a line that Kinnock had used because it was about his life in Britain. And so it was he was easily caught out. It was kind of a dumb mistake to make. He had quoted from the speech many times before with credit, with attribution, and then a couple of times he didn't. He was taken to account for that. Then it happened again with some lines from Robert F. Kennedy. And when he was confronted, he immediately apologized and said it was a terrible mistake, and he realized his campaign was over. But he said something really interesting. He said, when I'm angry, I exaggerate. And he understood this about himself. And I think he came to realize that he was exaggerating in part because he lacked the confidence that, that he could express these ideas as well as others did. That and it was really the nomination of Robert Bork to the Supreme Court that turned things around for Biden. It happened right at the time that his presidential campaign was falling apart. Bork was a arch conservative who was appointed to the court by Ronald Reagan, and Biden was running the Senate Judiciary Committee. It was his job to vet Bork, and many Democratic activists wanted him to defeat Bork. And Biden undertook a deep study of the constitutional law, sitting down with a lot of professors, really learning this stuff, and was able to attack Bork very effectively and torpedo the nomination. And that gave him a new confidence about his own ability to do the work. And the plagiarism problem seems to have subsided after that.
Well, that's interesting. And you also quote him saying about his plagiarism, I guess we can call them lies, right? that it was born out of his arrogance and, quote, I didn't deserve to be president. I mean, in today's environment, those are really surprising, almost shocking admission of wrongdoing by a politician.
Yeah, and it gets back to that humility and empathy that we were talking about earlier. These days, for somebody to say that, that would probably be the end of their presidential ambitions, the end of their hopes. And Biden was, looking back, we can say he played the long game. He either ran for president or considered running for president in 1980, 84, 88, 2004, 2008, 2016,
wow.
And of course last year. So that's a long, long list. So it on one hand reflects some failures to get anywhere in those races. It also reflects a certain humility about, well, this is not my time. I better stick to what I'm doing in the Senate. And it also reflects that he just keeps plugging no matter what.
Why do you think he won the nomination and now, of course, the presidency? Early on in the campaign, he was in the middle of the pack, didn't perform particularly well at the debates. There were other more interesting candidates that seemed to have the nomination or at least have the interest of the public and the press. And then something about South Carolina. How did he turn it around? I know he didn't do it by himself, but why do you think he won this time?
Well, on a purely kind of practical level, the help from Congressman Clyburn, James Clyburn of South Carolina, in rallying black voters to him in that South Carolina primary, that was sort of the pivot point for Biden. But I think the deeper thing going on here was that you had this enormous field of Democratic candidates, many of them quite progressive, and then you had good old Joe Biden, very centrist, his views and opinions are not going to offend anybody. He's rather straight down the middle. And in a country that is deeply traumatized, in a country that is suffering from the coronavirus, from the Trump presidency, from the chaos of the last 4 years, the idea that you could get a steady old guy who you knew in and out was not going to cause any scandals, was not going to cause any lurch to one extreme or another, that sense of security and stability appealed to an awful lot of voters, and I think still does. And so the trick for Biden is, how does he hew to his lifelong drive toward the center? He always called it the vital center. And also grab onto some of this progressive energy because this is a country that really wants things to change and really wants reform. So how do you do both of those things at once? The stability and security of a centrist and the boldness of a progressive who is looking to reform things, make the system better in the way of an FDR or an LBJ. And that's what he's got to weave. It's going to be tough.
Do you see that in his selection either of cabinet or members of his administration? Do you see centrism and progressivism at work?
You do. You see, it's an older cabinet for the most part. The continuing problem in American politics of having kind of a gerontocracy leading our country. It's a very experienced one. There are not a lot of showboats. There are very few, in fact. There are a lot of people who most Americans will never have heard of, some of these cabinet secretaries, even in the most prominent positions, because they were staffers. They were people who were actually doing the work and weren't the politicians out there winning votes and getting elected. So it's a different style of cabinet, but it's very much Joe Biden's style. These are people who are just going to sit down and get to work on policy stuff and aren't as involved as in selling policy as people in, say, the Trump administration were. And there's a risk there because you need somebody to get out there and sell the message. And yeah. It may not be those cabinet members.
As you were talking about just, the fact that this country is going through such suffering, such loss because of the pandemic, and yesterday's very simple but also very eloquent, very few words, lots of, visuals of the Lincoln Memorial and the Washington Memorial, and then, of course, the reflecting pool with those lights representing the 400,000 Americans who have died because of COVID. That was just a very striking and beautiful, heartbreaking moment.
It really was, and I'm glad you pointed out that there were so few words spoken. I think that's a really key insight into Biden and how he operates. We have a tendency to think of him as sort of a continuation of Obama, and he's not. He's a very different style of person, very different style of politician. So whereas Obama's instinct would have been to be very professorial, playing kind of the public preacher role in as he did so effectively after the Charleston shootings, that was Obama's instinct, was to sort of heal through words. Biden's is much more given, despite his age, it's much more the way a lot of young people in our country absorb information and ideas. It's through visuals, the very striking visuals, as you mentioned, on the National Mall last night, but also just the few words. He likes to cite poetry, especially Irish poetry, and he has that spareness of words and sometimes a clumsiness of words. But nonetheless, he is able to deliver emotion in a very powerful way, very reminiscent of Franklin Roosevelt, actually, this ability to connect with people in a very spare way.
Help us understand, and this will take, I think, probably years, maybe centuries, to understand how we went from Barack Obama to Donald Trump to Joe Biden. How does that work in a democracy such as ours?
I see Trump and Obama as very much the same impulse for many voters. That may seem like a wild statement, but in fact, I think many middle-class Americans and working-class Americans had been sending a very clear message for many years to Washington, and it kept not being received. And so people who initially voted for, say, a Ronald Reagan or a Bill Clinton, who were both seen as somewhat of outsiders who wanted to shake things up, and then, of course, the Ross Perot candidacy, and Obama was kind of the ultimate statement of that. His whole first campaign was about massive hope and change, changing the system, turning it upside down, addressing the needs of all these people who'd been left behind by the changes in technology, the changes to our economy, the loss of jobs, the loss of manufacturing. Trump's message was very similar to the first campaign of Obama. They're obviously extremely different people with extremely different answers, but their identification of the problem was almost identical. And so from that, we go to Biden, who had been talking since the 1980s about how the middle class was getting clobbered in our country, how we were losing the heart and soul of our jobs and communities, and the loss of manufacturing meant the loss of community, the loss of localism. So he's been talking about this for 40 years, and that, I think, was a big part of his appeal.
And he apparently is going to be talking about how to unify, bring this country together, which I'm think we can all agree will be a very tall order. Well, let's talk about President Trump. You wrote a book called Trump Revealed. He is snubbing this inauguration. He has not acknowledged that Joe Biden won. He incited a lot of people to go to the U.S. Capitol 2 weeks ago and, you know, storm the place, threaten members of Congress who are inside. Trump has revealed himself, has he not?
Yeah, I mean, the remarkable thing about Trump, when having spent time with him and writing this biography back in the 2016 campaign, is his incredible consistency. So, you know, many people over the course of the presidency said, oh, he's getting worse, this is unpredictable, and so on. I don't buy that for a second. He is one of the most consistent people I've ever had the chance to study. There's almost nothing that he did during this administration that he hadn't already done, either in the campaign or in his business career throughout his life. And so that sense of being the provocateur and being the sore loser and being someone who refuses to acknowledge when he's been defeated and who blames others, all of these things are shot through his entire life, from his casino business to his real estate business. There's simply not a chapter in his life where he hasn't done the same kind of thing, blamed others for his loss, walked away in a snit, stopped doing his job for a time because he was raging and boiling over some perceived conspiracy against him. So these are characteristics that are constant with him. Sadly, he was unable to change in any way to become a more effective president.
And he's going to face a trial in the U.S. Senate.
He is, a second trial for the first time in American history,
right.
and an odd one because he's already left office, or will have shortly. And so that raises all kinds of questions about what is the purpose of an impeachment of a president who has already left office. Is this about vengeance? Is this about accountability? Is this, as Joe Biden and some of his top aides believe, perhaps a mistake because they want to get on with their agenda and they want to turn the nation's attention to the crises that we're facing, and they see this continued attention to Trump as a distraction and possibly a dangerous one? So there are real problems and debates to be had about how this is going to be resolved. But at this point, there will be a trial. It's just a question of when, what form it will take, and, of course, what result.
Yeah, indeed. And interesting thing that Mitch McConnell, I guess yesterday, he was Senate Majority Leader, said, seeming to open the door to, if not a conviction, certainly a pretty vigorous trial in the U.S. Senate. Trump got, 74 million votes? That's a lot of the country.
It is a lot of the country. I think it's fair to say that a small portion of those 74 million, perhaps 20-25% of them, are the hardcore Trump voters who are going to stick with Trump no matter what, who want him to keep on fighting, maybe want him to run again. But I think the majority of those votes are people who had voted for him once or twice because he was a provocateur, because he was promising to turn things upside down. And some of those people have been gravely disappointed, not only by the attack on the Capitol and his incitement of that insurrection, but also by some of his moves. Just this morning, he rescinded his first executive order from when he became president, when he made a big show of saying that nobody who worked for him would be allowed to lobby the government after they left work. Well, this morning, very quietly, he pulled that back. Now they can go off and make big money after having worked for him. So that's the kind of thing that I think a lot of Trump voters have over the years come to see, that, you know, maybe, you know, the wall didn't get built and Mexico didn't pay for it, and so on and so on.
That's not called draining the swamp, right, Mark Fisher?
Right.
That is the swamp. Well, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Great to be with you, Marty.
Nice to have you with us as well. Senior editor at The Washington Post. And again, wrote a book a couple of years ago, Trump Revealed, the definitive biography of the 45th president. And that's it for today's edition of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. And you can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Charlie Kyer, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.